Prime time is anytime. Subscribe to the Primetime Sports Podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. You just got called up to the big league, son. Welcome to the show. This is Primetime Sports with Bob McCowan on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Part of the awkwardness of you coming in at 5 o'clock.
Yes.
Is we've already really talked about everything.
Well, I haven't. You have.
No, I know, but I mean, you know, it's not all about you.
Well, it's...
I've talked about it with other people. The audience has listened to it with other people. Now, I sort of feel like I have to regurgitate everything.
Well, regurgitate away.
Well, I don't...
Do you think the audience sits here for hours and hours and watches...
All evidence suggests they do.
Really?
Why would you leave? Just one compelling...
One compelling thing after another.
A thing after another, that's right.
Okay.
Jerry Eisenberg's going to join us in a few minutes.
Fantastic.
40th anniversary of the Rumble in the Jungle. How did it get 40 years later?
Man.
How'd that happen?
Jerry Eisenberg, the columnist.
You were a kid.
Yeah, I was. I was indeed. What do they call him? Columnist emeritus, I think, for the Newark Star-Ledger.
Yeah.
One of my favorite guys. And
been on the show before. He's great.
Oh, he's fantastic. He's been everywhere and done everything and has great stories, especially, though, about Ali. You know, I've interviewed him about Ali before and talked about Ali and about NFL history, which he's also great on. He just did a book on Roselle, which is tremendous. You know, Jerry's a hoot, but he's kind of living history. There aren't a lot of guys left.
I have t-shirts. 40th anniversary. Look at this.
Very nice.
There you go. Well, take a shot of it. There you go. Rumble in the Jungle. Ali Bumbaye. Remember it like it was yesterday. One of the more exciting moments in boxing history.
Well, you know, it's not, like, weirdly enough, yeah, not a great fight, but a great moment.
Well, that's what I said,
yeah,
moment.
Like a stunning, unbelievable, I can't believe I'm seeing what I'm seeing moment.
It was not supposed to happen.
Yeah.
Arguably more stunning than Cassius Clay beating Sonny Liston?
Yeah, in its own way, yeah. It's in, you know, when I think of the three, you know, that I saw that are like that, well, maybe it's more than that, but... Cassius Clay Liston, which went, you know, it's really before my time. Ali Foreman, for sure. Buster Douglas Tyson.
Well, that'd be another one.
Watching
Tokyo.
Tyson get dismantled in Tokyo, which no one thought would or could happen. And the other one for me still was George Foreman knocking out Michael Moore and winning the heavyweight championship.
At 50?
48 or whatever he was.
Okay.
And 46, I think. And that, because it came out of the blue and he was losing. He'd lost every round. He'd lost every minute of every round. And then suddenly he lands one punch, the guy's out, the whole place is going crazy. George is down on his knees praying in the corner. And I didn't see that one coming either, and it was amazing. So, but though, yeah, I can't think of, you know, there have been lots of upsets, but those are the ones where you kind of go, especially the first two, where, you know, the whole legend of Ali in a lot of ways is built on those two fights, if you mm-hmm. think about it, right? It's, you know, he came back from other things. He came back from the broken jaw that he suffered against Norton and then beat Norton. But really, the big ones were beating Liston when no one thought he could possibly beat Liston, and beating Foreman when no one thought, for totally different reasons, no one thought he could beat Foreman.
Yeah. We'll talk about it in a few minutes. Jerry Eisenberg will join us. Also, Don Banks of Sports Illustrated. And then after the top of the next hour, Len Bugard, the father of Derek Bugard, will join us in studio to tell us Derek's story. And how he believes the NHL's drug prevention program failed his son.
Yeah, that and a bunch of individual people, individual doctors and a whole bunch of people. But a lot of people let him down. You know, we had John Branch on a week ago, maybe more than a week ago, who wrote the book Boy on Ice, the New York Times reporter. But this is a continuing story. You know, and Len is a Len's a retired RCMP officer, so you know he has been conducting his own investigation, some of which appears in Branch's book. It's certainly the meat of John Branch's book comes from that.
But not all.
Not all, and it is continuing, and he lost a son. Mm-hmm. And he thinks a lot of people let his son down, and he's going to talk about that.
We hope you'll stick around for that, because we think it's not to be missed. That's at the top of the next hour. So, a few things happened last night.
Yeah.
A World Series game that was, we hoped before it started that it would be a game.
Yep.
It was as good a Game 7 in a World Series as I've ever seen.
Yes.
It had every ingredient, edge-of-your-seat drama, a storyline unparalleled, and a result that was improbable, but clearly not impossible.
Yeah, and a hero, you know, a guy who is not going to be an asterisk guy, right? No one's going to say, well, yeah, he was great that one time. You know, this is a guy who, you know, may wind up in the Hall of Fame purely because of what he's done in the postseason. You know, and I know
I might vote for him today.
And there's all those things about pitchers. You know, you have to have X number of wins and all of that stuff in your career. Although that number is going to go out the window at some point. There aren't going to be a lot of 300 win guys down the road. But you know, if you look at what Bumgarner has done, he's still a young guy. But what he has done in the World Series, even coming into this year, and then what he did in this postseason before he got to the World Series, and then you look at the three games in the World Series, like that's classic stuff. We talked about that this week. That. You know, it could have ended in Game 6, and that would have been interesting in its own way, and whatever would have happened. But the classic is three appearances, right, by a starter. Three appearances in the World Series. Now, it wasn't in the conventional way. He didn't start the game. But when he came in there and they gave him the ball, and Bochy just said, it's yours, you know.
Never had anybody warming up.
That's, you know, if you're a baseball fan, that stuff gives you tingles, right? You don't have to have a rooting interest, but if you like baseball.
Well, I mean, that's what I said. I mean, I said this in the last hour. I'm a baseball fan, and I hate the end of the season because it means winter's at hand, and yeah. I got to wait another 4 months for spring and to get excited about baseball coming. Because baseball defines the seasons for me living here in Canada. And I'm not a big winter fan. I confess to that. So I'm always a little saddened or a lot saddened when the baseball season comes to an end. But I sat there on the couch at the end of the game last night and watched the Giants celebrate. I really don't want this to end this year.
No.
I mean, I want there to be another game tomorrow night. I want to see more of this. It's not like I had a rooting interest
in
it.
Neither did I.
I didn't care who won the game, really.
Nope.
I mean, I was rooting for Bumgarner when he came in.
As soon as he was in the game, that was my rooting interest. I want to do something historic, right?
Yeah.
Don't you know, because if he'd fallen apart, you would have said, yeah, he's tired. Right? Look what the guy's pitched 260 innings this year or whatever it is. He's just worn out. He didn't have that last one in him. But, you know, what you're cheering for there is history, right? I want to see something special.
Yep.
And, you know, what we saw.
Did we get something special?
Well, and it turns like there were a lot of people. I just saw the TV numbers. You know, there were 1.2 million people in Canada watched that game last night.
That's really quite astounding.
Which is a good, you know, that's a good number, you know. And
it's a big number, yeah.
And it's a big number, and there was a lot of other stuff going on last night.
Yep.
And, but that's, people, sometimes we think kind of baseball's, people say, look at the World Series numbers in the States. They say, look, this is the lowest ever. It's always the lowest ever. You know, that's, the world has changed. The options have changed. Baseball's not where it was 40 years ago. Just, it's not. It's not as central. But, people can still get turned on to baseball. Baseball still has a place. And, you know, in some ways, what baseball did last night, no other sport can do. I don't think there's any sport that can give you that kind of sustained drama and sustained tension over as long a period as a great baseball game can.
Yeah, it has to be a great baseball game because, you know, what we saw 24 hours earlier was not
anything
but
a
great
beat down.
Game.
Yeah,
was a second inning over.
But just think of how from the first pitch to the last pitch last night, you know, you were engaged and it was like someone was spinning out it was like a novel.
Well, you know what it was? It was like, you were on a bit of a high invariably at the beginning of the game and you're sitting on the edge of the couch and you're watching this thing and you think it can't get any more tense. It's a 3-2 ball game and stuff is happening. And then all of a sudden Bumgarner comes into the ball game and you go, whoa.
Here we go.
And the expectation is, I mean, I thought he, they'll pitch him into the seventh. That's sort of what I thought.
Mm-hmm.
No, I think he, you know, I thought he could go more, but I thought they're going to pitch him into the seventh, and they're going to go to the pen.
And they got a terrific closer who they've hardly used
right.
in the World Series, but there he is, and he's been great. And
they never got him out of his chair.
Nope.
Never warmed him up. And then you want drama? Now it's two out. You know, victory is imminent. A little flare to center field. Center fielder charges.
Yeah,
doesn't get to it.
And you can see the wheels in the guy's head pop. That was the other moment, right, where he's charging the ball and thinking, I'm going to end the World Series.
With a great catch.
I'm going to make a diving catch. We are going to win the World. And you can almost see the, oh, my God, I'm not going to get there. And
then it's too late.
Then he's betwixt and between. And then the ball goes by him. And the guy bobbles it at the wall.
Boots it at the wall. And the next thing you got a guy on third. And you go, oh, my God, there's a whole bunch of ways these guys can tie this game up.
So just in that little
and
moment.
And the Bumgarner. And what are we talking about how great Bumgarner is if – if, you know, there's a passed ball, an error, a ground ball that finds a hole, you know.
Yeah, you don't
a
know.
Bloop
no,
something.
The story ends completely differently,
completely
right? And it's a different story. And we're saying, well, he was great. He came in and he pitched those innings. But, you know, somebody else had to do something somewhere along the line.
If you're watching on TV, there's the play. Oh, God.
Yeah. I'd say literally, I honestly thought this guy, you could see it. His eyes get big. He said, I'm going to be the guy. You know, because there's always that highlight, right? The last out.
Oh, yeah.
You know, remember who was it? George Bell caught the, when the Jays.
85.
When the Jays got in the playoffs, right?
Went down to his knees.
Yep. Everybody remembers that clip.
Yeah.
So this guy was going to be that, you know, for the third San Francisco World Series in 5 years. Unbelievable catch. And then, oh, my God, I'm in no man's land here. So that, you know, that just adds to that, the kind of beauty of the finish of that. You couldn't have scripted it better.
It was spectacularly rewarding.
So, yeah, and I'm like you, Bob. February 15th or whenever pitchers and catchers report is quite some time from now. So, I know we'll get there, but I will be missing baseball up until then.
So San Francisco's third baseman is a free agent.
Yes.
Got a chance to see a lot of him.
Yes.
Over the last few weeks.
He's always good in the postseason.
Yeah. Would you be happy with him at third base for the Toronto Blue Jays?
Yeah, I would. And I think that they have some interest in him. Now we'll start attaching asterisks to that. You know, you don't know where the market's going to go for him.
No.
You don't know what the term is going to be. And I think
he had two or three hits last night.
They are slightly leery of guys, you know, with that kind of body type. You know, that was part of the conversation around Prince Fielder, right? Those, you know, the non-traditional athletic body. That those guys, they worry about those guys breaking down. Of course, now Prince Fielder has broken down. It's not because he's a big guy, but he has broken down. So there would be, but you know, it's funny, you know, a month ago when I just started kind of hearing, okay, who might they be interested in? His Sandoval's name is one of the ones that came up. So, you know, it's in a lot of ways, yeah, it would be a nice fit, right? It would, you know, he's not a great defensive third baseman, although he's played fine in the World Series. You get offense out of him, you move Laurie over to second base.
He
ran the bases aggressively, and he's fun.
Big play.
And people would get a charge out of him, right? And it's, you know, and it's a Latino-friendly clubhouse. It would be a good place for him. But, you know, the market's going to be interesting for him. It'll be interesting to see where it goes.
We're going to call an audible here, as they tend to do occasionally, you know, with quarterbacks.
Okey-doke.
Mr. Eisenberg's a few minutes away from a phone, so we're going to move him down the lineup one slot.
Okey-doke.
And our friend Don Banks of Sports Illustrated, fortunately, was available. And so here he is on the phone. So I know it's football. I know that's your job, but were you watching the baseball game last night?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's actually that's the sport I'm still a fan of. So, yeah, I was waving Alex Gordon home from third.
Oh, were you?
Yeah, you know what? I mean, Nate Silver wrote a pretty interesting piece on why, you know, statistically it may have been the right move. I had no faith in Salvador Perez at this point to hit Bumgarner. Mm-hmm. And just the absolute freak nature of throwing home, what can happen, a bad throw, catcher drops the ball, so somebody slides into the glove. I might have taken a shot there. But my first response was, why wasn't he? Mentally, I had him in the vicinity of second by the time that ball was near the wall. And if that ball is out in that part of that park, and it's admittedly one of the most spacious outfielders in the major leagues, they kept talking about it, you should be able to score from second on what amounts to kind of a you know, single to the wall territory. So I don't know if he ran hard. I never saw the footage from first or from home to first, but I was waving Alex Gordon home. I thought it would have been a heck of a way to, one way or the other, either tie that game or end the series with that play.
Well, yeah. Well, and I'm going to guess, too, that you're right, that he probably didn't run that hard to first because he thought, it's single. Either going to get caught or it's going to be a single.
Yep.
And maybe he gets to first at that point and thinks, okay, it's going to be a double, and maybe doesn't run 100% until he gets closer to second. He sees it get right. booted around, and then he turns on the Jets going to third, and that's when the camera picked him up.
I mentally, it seemed like that play took forever, and I thought
it did.
This is a real shot at, I know it's not an inside the park home run, but it's the effect of that. And
right.
I thought, oh my God, if they tie the game on that with two outs against Bumgarner, that's one of the most amazing turns and twists in World Series history. And he never really, looked like he was contemplating coming home. And I that's unfortunate because yeah. I would have loved to have seen it.
Even if he gets thrown out, Don, it would have been one of the great moments, because you're forcing the Giants to make that relay, right? It would have been unbelievable.
Right. When has a series ever ended remotely like that? Never. Yeah. So a foul pop to third is a little less dramatic.
Yeah, but it's still kind of had a cherry on top, though, because of who was pitching. So I'm okay with that, and I understand what you're saying. Yeah, the other thing would have been fantastic, but yeah, I'm still okay. Before we look ahead to this week, Don, in the National Football League, I just want to look back a little bit at Monday night and the strange events in the Dallas-Washington game, the Tony Romo as Willis Reed, and uh-huh. Jerry Jones on the sidelines, perhaps ordering him back into the game or saying he was available or not doing that, and then materializing mysteriously in his owner's box 20 seconds later, and all of that stuff. what is our takeaway from the Dallas Cowboys and their loss Monday night, and whether the circus is back in town?
It certainly had elements of it. You do come to expect a certain amount of farce with the Cowboys. And look, I long since came to grips with Jerry's the owner. He's the GM. He's whatever he wants to call himself. He is going to be there and interject himself where traditionally you don't see other owners do that. But you don't see other owners calling themselves general manager either. So I wasn't shocked that he was down there and that he interjected himself into that situation. I do think there should have been grown-ups in the room who said, Romo can't go back in this game. For one, there were too many unknowns, really, about how much pain he was feeling. And he was out of that game for a long time. And his replacement put 10 points on the board. Mm-hmm. It's not as if they had no shot without Tony Romo. I would have gone literally with the hotter hand in Brandon Whedon. And I never thought I'd say I was rooting for a game that featured two backup former Browns quarterbacks in Colt McCoy and Brandon Whedon, but I think that would have given Dallas its best shot. So I thought there was kind of lack of institutional control that Tony Romo either talked his way back into that game or was given the go-ahead by medical when the x-rays proved negative on his back.
But an x-ray on a back injury, again, I'm not a doctor, nor do I play one on television, but you need a CT scan, don't you? You can't tell everything about a back injury, and because the consequences could be so. The guy has had two surgeries, but you don't want to mess around with a back injury. That's what I'm saying. And I that was one of those ones where if he goes back in and doesn't get up after getting walloped and fumbling the ball as he did later on, there would have been unbelievable consequences. Would there? It's just there's a lot of risk there. Never mind the football aspect of it, but it seemed like a bad moment in a lot of ways.
I agree. I thought it was a send in the clowns type of moment on the sideline. I get Romo's trying, as you say, play Willis Reed, but he really shouldn't be a big part of the discussion. And it looked like he was talking his way back in the game. And it looks like the owner kind of went down there and gave him the seal of approval. I thought that's where it broke down on the Dallas sideline. And, we thought they had kind of looked like the new and improved Cowboys, like they were going to be disciplined and stick to their formula. And then big game Monday night, arch rival, first deficit they faced in quite a while late in the game, and they kind of reverted a little bit to classic Cowboys form.
Let's move ahead to tonight's stellar matchup. between two sub-500 teams.
Speaking of sending the clowns, right?
Yes, thank you. Carolina Panthers and the New Orleans Saints. I know there are people that are surprised by the Panthers' record. Maybe some are surprised by Atlanta's. Maybe even some are surprised by Tampa's record. But the most surprising thing in that division to me is the New Orleans Saints, who've just kind of been fooling around out there. Haven't really got it going. Have won some football games, but haven't been able to sustain anything. What do you think's wrong with that team? Is it more flawed than I thought they were at the beginning of the season?
Yes, and I picked them to go to the Super Bowl and win it.
Oops.
I saw them in camp, and I thought they were a juggernaut material. I heard one theory put to me from a former NFL head coach that I thought had a lot of validity, and that team had gotten so used to relying kind of on the Drew Brees Star Wars passing offense and the points palooza that it had gotten a little lazy and lax when it came to what it takes to win close games late. And that has been the problem, because if you want to dissect the 0-4 away record, I think three times they've given away late leads in close games and not made the play. I think it happened in Atlanta in week one. It happened against your beloved Cleveland Browns.
It did.
And it happened again in Detroit in a game they had a big lead and watched the Lions come back. And I think it's indicative of a team that kind of thought, well, all we have to do is get Drew Brees out there, hold the other team to 20 points, and we're fine. And I think mentality-wise, they lost a little bit of the edge that it takes to play close, tight games and find the way to win them.
But they did, you know, they kind of righted the ship on Sunday night, didn't they? And I guess, you know, Jimmy Graham.
Yeah, but it's been off and on.
Yeah, but you're right, it has. And they you know, and the blown leads, you know, are something. But I think Jimmy Graham being healthy in the second half against the Packers, I know it's at home where the Saints do have a distinct advantage, or historically have, but I kind of felt by the end of that game that maybe, you know, that maybe they're back on track again.
I agree. I think it was a corner turned. We'll find out tonight. I think they're going to win tonight. I mean, the crazy thing is one of these two teams are going to the playoffs. That's just the reality of that division. Tampa Bay's 1-6, Atlanta's 2-6. I don't think either one of those can put together the kind of sustained run to even get to 8-8, which bare minimum I think it's going to take 8-8 and probably 9-7 before all is done. But I think New Orleans finds a way to go 2-6 on the road this year in their own 4, and then I think they go 7-1 at home because they've got some tough games at home still coming. And they go 9-7, and they win that division. But tonight, to me, whoever wins tonight is not only in first place; they have the inside track then for the rest of the season.
Yeah, because tie goes to them, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And New Orleans' schedule, as I looked at it earlier in the season, is significantly tougher in the second half than the first, isn't it?
Yeah, they're about to go home, which is the good news. But the bad news is it's San Francisco, Cincinnati, and Baltimore. Then they go to Pittsburgh, which could be a tough place for them to win. Then they have Carolina at Chicago, Atlanta at home, and at Tampa Bay. So other than the last 2 weeks, which you would think the Falcons and the Bucks would have the cars idling in the parking lot by then, it's a pretty good stretch starting with tonight's game.
Who should we be looking for tonight? Is there a storyline specifically in this game?
I would think Carolina is going to win if Cam Newton has a big game, because he hasn't really – I think he's had one 100-yard rushing game this season. If he can use his legs, and obviously coming off the ankle surgery, it's kind of late in the offseason, he really hasn't looked to be the dual threat, the multidimensional type of quarterback. But if he has a game, Carolina could easily win. They just haven't had what they had on defense remotely, and the Greg Hardy departure, as it were, has really hurt their pass rush and I think put them in a back-on-their-heels mode without getting heat on the other passers. So I think Breeze is going to have a good night, but if Newton kind of goes off, and let's say he can find rookie Kelvin Benjamin a couple times in big situations, that's how Carolina wins this game.
Do you think last Sunday's 13-9 loss to Seattle was a moral victory in any way for Carolina, or is a loss? And especially given Seattle might not be as good as they have been.
I would tend to say no, and here's why. It's a third straight year Russell Wilson has gone into Charlotte and won a low-scoring, kind of grind-it-out type of victory. The scores have been like 16-12, 13-9, and I think for like 14-10 the last 3 years, and all three times they've lost. So I don't take any great meaning out of that. I think it just showed once again that Seattle's defense is better than what Carolina can put up against them offensively. And to me, it was a bigger win for, you know, the much bigger win for Seattle just to kind of staunch the bleeding and get their feet back under them to a degree than it was a moral victory for Carolina.
Now, on the weekend, we have chapter whatever it is, Brady v. Manning. It's been an interesting road getting here. It's not exactly the road, you know, I guess for the Broncos, it has been kind of everybody thought they would be good and Manning sets the record, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, the Patriots going from God awful and it's all over to an unstoppable juggernaut. What do we have in store here, Don? Like, I guess it is a bit of a litmus test for the Patriots one more time, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, you know, let's not overthink this. This could be the winner gets kind of the inside track on AFC number one seed, and that was really important for Denver because come the AFC title games last year, it was New England coming to them. I don't think the gap that we thought existed between these two teams, even after the playoff game last year, really exists at this moment. I mean, look, I really, like Denver more than anybody in the AFC to get back to the Super Bowl, but I think that they really have started figuring things out in New England. And when you see Gronkowski look like Gronkowski again, as he did last week, mm-hmm. and Amendola even helped him win a game a couple of weeks ago when he had been almost non-existent in the offense, and Brandon LaFell, who is one of those classic, you know, he goes to New England and looks better than he ever did anywhere else, they're starting to get the semblance of their passing game together. And I think it's a very dangerous time for Denver to be catching New England. That's obvious. And I like New England to find a way, you know, 34-30 or something like that in Foxborough, whereas I wouldn't if the game was in Denver. I'd take the Broncos by, you know, double digits.
At the midway point in the season, we invariably start looking at coaches who may be in some peril. It seems to me that the only guy everybody's talking about is Rex Ryan. Are there others?
Yeah. I think Mike Smith is in a lot of trouble.
In Atlanta.
And I don't think he survives it. And I think he's a good coach. He didn't forget how to coach this last year and a half. But they're 6-18 in his last 24. And what's going to be interesting is him and the general manager, Thomas Dimitroff, came in together in 2008. And they've been joined at the hip. I'm starting to hear that they may not be so joined at the hip. And if there's separation there between those two, then that tells me Dimitroff's in survival mode and Smith is in big trouble. And I think it's just that quintessential NFL problem that the guy has been there, he's won, they got to a plateau, they couldn't get higher, then they slid back, and that makes it seem all the worse. And they need a fresh voice. It's gotten stale in Atlanta, and Mike Smith's probably going to pay the price. And you know, I don't think Joe Philbin's out of the woods in Miami. Mm-hmm. The rest of the season is hugely important. Whether he comes back, it does look like Rex probably is gone, just because that's got debacle written all over it. And
you want another one? You know who's number two on my list? Tressman in Chicago.
Well,
I think he's in real peril.
I do, too, for reasons...
I don't think it's his fault, necessarily.
I was going to say, for reasons that are not completely his fault, but I've said this before, I like Mark, and I think he's a smart guy, and you guys know him from his Canadian football experience. I've known him for a long time. He's just not a great fit for what that team needs in a way, because there's nobody... When you don't have a head coach or a quarterback who has a real knack for leadership in the way that you have to have sometimes in the league when things are going bad, somebody got to stand up and command the room and kind of verbally stop the bleeding. They don't have that at their quarterback, so that makes Mark's natural tendency to be soft-spoken and cerebral and not be able to really lead in that, I don't know, vocal manner really kind of glaring. And when you add in that this team passed on Bruce Arians, and Bruce Arians would have been, he would have had a steakhouse named after him in Chicago already after a year and a half. He is a Chicago kind of blunt talking, no nonsense, yep, Ditka knockoff type of guy. They would have adored him. He probably would have won there. And they said no thanks to him and hired Trestman. And that decision is looming large, as is the Cutler contract extension.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Arians has built that kind of team somewhere else. You know, he's
exactly.
Yeah. We got Carolina and New Orleans in the Alphonse and Gaston Bowl tonight. And on Thursday Night Football, you take it. I don't want it. Mr. Banks, enjoy the game. Enjoy the weekend. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, guys.
Don Banks of Sports Illustrated. When we come back, Jerry Eisenberg around now. We're going to talk to him next. 40th anniversary of Ali Foreman, The Rumble in the Jungle, when primetime continues on the Sportsnet radio and television networks.
This ain't like when you're at a game and sign up for a credit card just to get the prize and then you immediately cancel the credit card. Because there's no prize when you sign up for our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Now, more of Bob McCowan and Primetime Sports on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Before the hour, Jerry Eisenberg's on the other line with somebody, so we're going to wait for him.
I've been to Jerry's house, and the scene that Ryan described, I've seen that scene. I know exactly what's going on there right now.
His wife's on one phone with us, and he's on the other phone.
Yeah, I think there's probably a lot of yelling going on right now. That's just my guess. Not like happy yelling. I don't mean like angry yelling, but just
Jerry, someone's on the phone. Kind of yelling?
It might be something like that right now, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a great scene. And he's a great guy. And I look forward to him figuring out that we're the guys on the phone.
What do you remember of that time? I mean, there was drama. People might not remember. We're talking about Ali and Foreman 40 years ago in a fight that became known as the Rumble in the Jungle. Actually, it was billed as the Rumble in the Jungle.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. Whatever, you know, I think what's kind of lost on people now, if they weren't alive then, is the fact that is what Foreman was. Everybody knows the legend of Ali now. You know, and they understand what it meant that he won this against impossible odds and the rope a dope and all that stuff. But you know, Foreman, you know, he came out of the '68 Olympics, won the gold medal in Mexico City. Big, huge, kind of slow guy. People wondered what he would be as a professional. And they get him, you know, rather quickly gets a heavyweight title fight against Joe Frazier in Kingston, Jamaica. And in a fight, everybody figures Frazier's going to win because, you know, Frazier's got to beat Ali. And
yep.
Joe's got a devastating left hook, great fighter in his prime. And, you know, it's one of those style things, right? Styles make fights. And Foreman just knocked him around the ring.
Yep.
Knocked him down six times. You know, everybody, the Howard Cosell, Frazier, down goes Frazier. And that, so he wins that fight. I think his first title defense then was against Joe King Roman in Tokyo. It was just a plug. But then he fought Norton. And Ken Norton remembers the guy who'd beaten Ali. So, and they fought in Caracas, Venezuela. The fights were in weird places in those days. So they're in Caracas, Venezuela. Ken Norton's a big deal. He's beaten Ali. He's got the weird style.
Well, I was going to say, Norton is not, I mean, he's not the same, but he wasn't dissimilar to Frazier in some ways.
Well, he didn't punch like Joe, but no one punched like Joe. But he had the kind of cross-arm style.
Well, he had the cross-arm thing.
Yeah, and Eddie Futch, you know, was his trainer. And so he fights George Foreman, and George Foreman knocks him all over the ring and knocks him out in two rounds. So George Foreman looks like a guy.
It looked like Sonny Liston.
Yeah, that no one's ever going to beat,
yep.
Right? That he is unbeatable, and he's got this, in those days, he's not the happy pitch man selling.
Oh, no.
He's got this, you know, kind of stern. You know, in Mexico City, waved the American flag and, you know, was after the Black Power salute, so people liked that, but some people liked it. But, you know, in the ring, he was this guy just kind of glowering.
Oh, he was the bad guy.
Yeah. And he just
looked, was the man in black.
And so now you're going to serve him up Ali, who has, you know, lost to Frazier and has lost to Norton and looks like he's, you know, this is the decline. This is nothing like the guy from this. He can't dance anymore. He can't move. He is a flat-footed guy without much power, who talks a good game, but is about to be served up to this monster, right? This guy who, you know, as you say, like Liston, could hurt guys with a jab, was lifting, you know, lifted Fraser off the canvas with a punch that he hit him with. Hit him so hard that he came off the canvas for a second and then before he went down. So that's what it felt. And people were worried about Ali. You know, people thought he was going to get hurt. That he, you know, that he just, there was no, he wouldn't have an answer for this guy because, you know, again, the only answer that Ali could have had for a guy like that would have been what he did to Liston, which was move and stick and jab and humiliate him and beat him with, but he couldn't move anymore.
Yeah.
So he's going to stand in front of this guy or he's going to dance for a round and then he's going to run out of gas. And of course he did get up on his toes in the fight and then he stopped and then he stood there. And even then, so even during the fight, people said, oh, that's it. He's out of gas. He can't dance anymore. He's leaning up against the ropes. He's covering up. And George Foreman's just going to chop him down, and here it comes. And just let's hope he doesn't get hurt too badly. That's the part that's kind of lost now, is that Foreman was a big deal, you know, and at the first incarnation of Foreman, that he was a big deal, that he was unbeatable, unstoppable, and that Ali, in his repertoire at that point, didn't seem to have anything that he could use against this guy.
Now, you know, it was prior to this fight, prior to the first scheduled fight, because people forget the fight was postponed.
Mm-hmm. 6 weeks.
It was prior to that fight that I first met Muhammad Ali. And it was at that point that he first unveiled the now famous poem. You know, Ali hits with a left, he hits with a right, he knocks George Foreman clear out of sight, and who'd have thunk when they come to the fight that they'd see the launching of the first colored satellite, Muhammad Ali. Do you have any expectation that had the fight gone as scheduled 6 weeks earlier, the outcome might have been different?
It's an interesting, you know, that has been speculated on. And it could be good if we find Jerry, if his wife finds Jerry, it'll be great. That'd be something to ask him, because, you know, a lot of people thought that it messed with Foreman. It messed with Foreman's head, you know, because he didn't leave, right? And he wasn't having a good time in Zaire. And, you know, they famously, the story was that...
Well, Ali was the king there, for those that aren't aware of the story. Kind of, he was the hero.
And he got the locals all, you know, behind him. And, you know, Foreman, after he got cut in training and the fight was postponed, he wanted to go home. And they wouldn't let him.
Yeah.
You know, because I think they knew that if he goes, that fight's never happening in Zaire. He's going to, you know, that fight might happen somewhere else. But, you know, and of course, this is Don King's. You remember, this is the debut of Don King as a big-time promoter.
That's right.
He's got the, you know, he got the money out of the dictator in Zaire. So there's a lot of, then there's a concert and there's all kinds of weird stuff going on. But yeah, I think there are a lot of people who believe that Foreman, you know, psychologically was messed up and that physically, you know, he was at his peak and probably ready to go, and that the 6 weeks didn't do him any good and might have done Ali some good, you know. But more than negative with Foreman, that he just, that it kind of made him, you know, he got a bit stir crazy there. And so when he walked into the ring that morning, because it was 3 a.m. local time, that he was not the guy he might have been 6 weeks before. You know, it's one of those great questions of history, though. Yeah, what happens? What happens if he doesn't get cut? What happens if the fight goes on? You know, it's easy to say, what happens if Foreman wins? Ali's career's over. You know, he might have tried to fight on, but the sense that of him as a spent force...
I think you're probably right.
You know, if you think of the fights he'd lost...
I mean, you got to remember, he fought another 8 years.
I know, and not necessarily, you know, wasn't necessarily to... It didn't do him a lot of good. You know, I kind of wish he hadn't fought those last 8 years.
Because he took
some beatings.
Yeah, there were probably as many bad moments as there were good moments.
Even when he was winning fights, you know, he took a lot of punishment. But, you know, if you look at that last part of his career, you know, there were some great triumphant moments as well. You know, the thrill in Manila is still to come.
Yep.
Beating Norton if you believe he won the third fight. Regaining the title from Spinks. You know, yeah, there's a lot of stuff to come, but really, you know, and I guess the thrill in Manila is still, you know, that's still in the pantheon of great Ali moments, but it doesn't, it kind of starts going downhill after this anyway, really, in a lot of ways. Like, the legend is bigger than it's ever been, but, you know, I think this is the last moment of kind of pure magic.
I don't know if you agree with this assessment, and I remember, I don't remember whether I watched the fight on closed circuit or whether I watched the fight afterwards on tape delay, but, I mean, I remember the night, and it was shocking. you really had to understand that Foreman was the prohibitive favorite. The smart money was all on Foreman.
Yep.
Nobody thought anybody could beat him, much less Muhammad Ali, who, after it coming back from that the layoff now, had shown vulnerability.
I'm going to fill in for Jerry here. Jerry picked Ali to win the fight.
He did, huh?
Yes. So I'll fill in for Jerry here.
Well, I wouldn't have.
No, neither would I. I thought he was going to get hurt. I was worried he was going to get hurt. And I liked Foreman. I always liked Foreman.
Oh, I didn't like Foreman until afterwards. And I mean, Foreman underwent a complete metamorphosis.
Oh, as a person.
A personality-wise.
Yeah, I know he did, or at least he found a character.
And his image, he went from being the Black Knight to the White Knight.
Yeah.
Later on in his career, when he made the comeback and winds up winning the heavyweight title late in his 40s. Right?
Oh, yeah. No, by then, you know.
He's a hero then.
Well, he made the comeback. People laughed at him. You know, I remember going to see him. I saw him fight on his 40th birthday in Rochester, New York against, Steve Zuski or somebody like that, some plug they put him in with. So that was early. That comeback tour was a joke, right? Because he was huge, right? This big fat guy comes back and everybody's
laughing. Had he shaved his head by then?
No, his head was not. Had he shaved? Yeah, maybe he had shaved his head. But it was that whole comeback was just a kind of a goof. People made fun of him, this old fat guy. And then, remember, he fought Holyfield and did okay, right? He had some, he kind of held his own against Holyfield. And it was, a little less of a joke. And then, the Moore fight, and who else? He fought Jerry Cooney, knocked out Jerry Cooney.
Right.
The geezers at Caesars. So there were, it was this kind of awful sideshow thing in small arenas in front of small crowds. And finally, he got himself all the way back. And all the time, he's this, becoming this pitch man guy.
Yeah.
Right? The salesman. And he pitches himself all the way into another shot at the heavyweight title.
But he became likable.
I think he was, I think he relaxed. If you ask him, it's kind of like people forget, that may or may not know that, he came back after the Ali fight. He fought on. He had the crazy fight with Ron Lyle where they were both down like five times. And then he thought he saw, he didn't. It's up to, I'll take his word for it, that God spoke to him.
Yep.
When he was in the dressing room afterwards and told him to stop fighting. Gil Clancy was his trainer. Gil Clancy always told the story that George thought he had a vision and said, you have to go preach. And he became a street preacher.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
Walked away. So, and then the guy who came back and decided to fight to make money for his church, to keep his church and rec center going in Houston, was a different human being. Just
completely.
A different personality. And, he parlayed that into the HBO gig and, again, all those grills. I think he's made as much money selling those grills as he ever did boxing.
I might have, although he made a pretty good buck on boxing. But I think he's made a lot of
money. It's like people laugh about that, but he made a ton of dough on those things.
A lot of money selling grills.
And he's had kind of a happy, he's kind of having a second, you're not supposed to have second chapters, right? You're not supposed to be able to reinvent yourself that way. And he reinvented himself both as a fighter and as a personality.
Quickly before we go, the last, and obviously we're not going to get Jerry here. The last point on Ali, the one thing I recall was the Foreman knockout as ninth round. As unexpected as it was, as dramatic as it was, a combination of punches, but really one right hand that landed real strong.
Foreman didn't want to get up, though. He was just done.
Yeah. I agree with you 100%. But it was at that point I remember thinking, Muhammad Ali is magic.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, he didn't. He wasn't knocking people out.
He will always find, he will do something that will amaze you.
Yeah. No, that's the one. That's, again, the
list. That's the moment.
The first Liston fight, the second Liston fight for all its weirdness.
Yeah, but we didn't know him then.
No, but this one was one where you said there's no
chance.
He
had no reputation. He was just a guy who won a gold medal.
And he didn't beat him. He knocked him out.
Yeah.
But again, I think George sat there and had time to contemplate whether he wanted to continue. And I think he made the decision not to continue. He was done. He was spent. So
it's emotionally or physically?
Physically, every way. He'd worn himself out physically. I think he just didn't want to be there.
Yeah.
Which is taking nothing away from Ali because he did still clip him with that right hand.
40 years ago, it was quite a night. When we come back, Len Bugard joins us in studio, the father of Derek Bugard. He'll tell Derek's story from his perspective and how the National Hockey League's drug prevention program failed his son. That's coming up on Primetime.